Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint at WDEV Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis. Big show today. In hour one, we're talking about COVID-19. As we approach winter, how should we be approaching the pandemic? Is it over? Is it coming back? What other risks are there? We'll try to answer your questions and concerns with Anne Sosin of Dartmouth College, a national expert and researcher on COVID and a prominent voice nationally on how the public and governments should be, have responded and should be responding. We'll do some open phones in hour two, take your questions about the first hour around COVID because there's so much to answer. I am not the expert, but we'll try to get your questions answered. And then we'll get into the details of the upcoming Wheels for Warmth program in hour two. We'll have a guest from that program and we'll tell you all the details about where you can go to get rid of your tires. All proceeds going to charity to keep people warm this winter. You can reach us today at 244-1777 or by email, vermontviewpoint@radiovermont.com. vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. We welcome your questions. But first, let's turn to COVID. Anne Sosin is a policy fellow at the Nelson Rockefeller Center at Dartmouth College. She's a public health practitioner, researcher, and educator focused on issues of health equity globally and in rural northern New England. She's got two decades of experience leading public health partnerships at local, national, and international level. And she focuses on COVID-19 and rural health equity. She holds a BA from Dartmouth College and a master's in public health from Johns Hopkins University. Anne, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Kevin.
You've made a name for yourself, not just with your academic work and your policy work, but you are, where I found you on Twitter, you are an authoritative and vocal voice. One of the reasons I asked you to come on the show is because you have a broad platform on this issue, it's refreshing to see a practitioner, not just in the peer-reviewed journals, as a clinician, but also where the rest of us toil in newspapers, magazines, and online. So thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start generally. With winter coming, where are we with COVID? Are the numbers going in a good direction or a bad direction? We've got all sorts of conflicting information out there with midterm elections coming up. You've got politicians wanting to say that the pandemic is over, including the President of the United States. And I suspect that that is not the case. So can you give us a general overview of where we are with COVID at the moment?
Sure, that's a great question and a great starting point for our conversation today. So certainly we're not in the same place that we were in 2020. We're not in the same place that we were in fall of 2021. But we're not at a point where we can say that the pandemic is over. And I am concerned that President Biden and other politicians are really minimizing COVID by declaring it over at a time when we need to be redoubling our efforts to combat the pandemic. We're coming into this fall with a broader arsenal of tools. We have updated boosters. We have expanded therapies, including Paxlovid. And we also have a better understanding of the virus and how it spreads. That said, we've let down a lot of our defenses as a country. We have increasingly thin guidance to respond to the pandemic. We haven't achieved adequate coverage of the tools that we have, including boosters and treatments. And we have a lot of confusion around how we need to move forward. In addition, we're facing down this fall with health systems that have sustained considerable stress over the last the 3 years. Health systems have encountered surge after surge. Many are facing acute and chronic workforce shortages. And we are also worried about the threat of flu and RSV. So there is a lot to be concerned about, even though we have more tools to respond to the pandemic this fall.
So I would note that in the New York Times last Sunday, the lead COVID writer, Apoorva Mandavili, wrote about what you just referred to, which is the a twindemic or even a triple-demic.
Triple-demic.
Yeah, with a third pathogen. So I have it right in front of me, so I'm going to go slowly. So you've got COVID, you've got the flu, and then you've got this thing called RSV, which is another respiratory syncytial virus in the mix. So cases of flu begin to tick up earlier than usual and are expected to go up as we go inside for winter. And then there are children infected with RSV. So let's talk about that. When you do these health subjects, and you've done this way more than me, you want to strike that balance. You don't want to unnecessarily alarm people, and you don't want to be a downer. However, there is a responsibility to tell people what is coming and what they're facing. So let's try to balance that. But let's talk about that triple-demic.
Yeah, and I might describe it as a viral blizzard that's, you know, already making landfall. So, you know, we continue to see COVID, and COVID is creeping up in many places, including here, even though we have fairly scant data to monitor the pandemic here. We're also seeing rising levels of RSV, which primarily affects younger children. Many pediatric hospitals are overwhelmed with cases of RSV, and there's also concern that we're seeing an earlier and potentially more severe flu season. But really, I would say that, you know, we don't need to respond with hysteria. What we need to do is think, you know, how do we equip ourselves well to confront these dual or triple threats that we're facing? And that means putting our tools to really good use as quickly as we can.
And those tools, let's go down that slowly. So the tools that if you're a parent with two children in school, and you just heard what we began talking about, the triple-demic, what are those tools? What should parents of kids, caregivers of the elderly, across the board, parents with no kids, people with comorbidities, what are those tools that they should be stocking up on going into winter?
Sure. So the first thing that we all want to do is ensure that we're up to date on our vaccines. And that means getting the updated COVID booster. It's now available for everyone over the age of 5. That means getting the flu vaccine, ideally as soon as possible, given that we're seeing flu already. So that's the first step that we can take. The other thing that we know is that COVID spreads through the air, and so going back to using our masks, and we really want high quality masks, so not the cloth masks that we were using at the beginning of the pandemic, but ideally N95s or the equivalent. Also want to use testing as much as possible with COVID. Testing is a really powerful tool that enables us to do a lot of the things that we have been doing, you know, that we've done before, but in a way that reduces risk for everyone. So those are a couple of things that we should be doing right now.
I have a stack of rapid COVID tests in my kitchen. I've got several boxes of N95 masks with ear loops, not head straps. I have not received. Well, here's a technical question for you. I am vaccinated and I had a first booster. I have not had a second booster because I got COVID, and probably 2 months ago. And what I'm reading is that I shouldn't get the second booster shot for maybe another month. But here again, I don't want to spread bad information. So maybe you could clear that up. So if you've got COVID, if you had COVID and you have recovered, as I did, when do you then get a booster shot?
That's a great question and one that many have. And I do want to say, you know, that there are some different viewpoints on this question.
Right.
But generally,
right.
You want to wait two months out to get that updated booster. And that's going to give you more mileage out of the booster, especially since we don't know when the next boosters are coming.
Right. Okay. And are those booster shots free, or
they are free?
Do you have to pay for them?
Boosters continue to remain free for everyone.
Okay, so the federal government's paying that bill, or state government is paying that bill?
The federal government is paying for boosters right now.
Okay.
And there is a plan eventually to commercialize those products. That hasn't happened yet. So everyone can get an updated COVID booster right now for free.
Okay.
And you can get that at the pop-up clinics that are happening around the state. Also, our pharmacies are doing booster shots. So there are many locations right now to get that booster.
I was walking through the Davis Center at University of Vermont yesterday, and the line for booster shots was out the door. So that was... They're making it easily accessible and free. So, and I have a specific question: flu shots versus COVID shots. I know you deal with the complicated and the academic, but I'm trying to get to some of these questions that I think regular folks need to know and want to know. So, you should get a flu shot. Should you then get a COVID booster? Should you wait? Should you separate those two? How should we approach that?
So I would say get both as soon as you can. You can do it at the same time. I received both at the same time. My 10-year-old also received both at the same time. So I would say do what's easiest for you right now. It's not necessary to space them out.
Interesting. Why is that? Just out of curiosity. They're two different vaccines. Is there ever any concern that the two combine into a cocktail that may not be in your health interest?
There are times when vaccines are spaced out, but infectious disease specialists and vaccinologists don't believe it's necessary with these specific vaccines to space them out. It may be the case that for some people you feel a little bit additional fatigue or side effects from having both at once. But some people really have no side effects from either or both of the vaccines. So experiences are highly variable.
Yeah, it really does vary. I know my son didn't feel well for a day. I was fine. But you're right, it is variable. And with President Biden suggested, I believe it was on 60 Minutes maybe last week, 2 weeks ago, that the pandemic is, quote, over. Millions of people going back to normal, football games, nightclubs, restaurants. There seems to be a kind of a divide between, and I get it, a divide between what the public is willing to do and how the public is willing to behave versus what the medical community knows are the facts. And then you throw in the political environment in which you know, you've got a president of the United States who wants to be able to say this thing is over. You can go back to work. You can go back to the office. You know, and then throw in all the tribal politics that we have going on in the country today. Boy, that makes for a pretty complex brew for us to get real information. Why do you think Biden said that? And should he have said it or should he not have said it?
You know, so there's been a great desire on the part of President Biden and other policymakers to declare victory on the virus. As you'll recall, the Biden administration had set the date of July 4th, 2021 is, you know, a milestone at which we would be, you know, declare victory on the virus and we would celebrate, the end of the pandemic or the end of that phase of the pandemic. Unfortunately, the Delta variant emerged just a few weeks later. And, you know, we are still now, in the pandemic. There are a lot of political interests, that are driving some of those declarations. We're facing, the midterms right now. There are other competing priorities, and so I would say that that is a political, not a public health declaration that he made on 60 Minutes. Unfortunately, what many of us are concerned about is that this really saps the energy around both the policy response as well as the actions of the public. If your president and others have told you that the pandemic is over, you're probably less likely to rush out and get a booster, get a supply of masks and tests, and actually use them, maybe to seek care if you have, the start of an infection. And so we're worried, that many are going to respond to that in ways that are going to hold us back, as we go into the winter. At the same time, many of us are concerned that this constant refrain that we're done, things are back to normal is really undermining, work to secure the resources we need to fight the pandemic. Congress still hasn't, renewed funding. So funding is running dry at a time when we need to be investing in innovation, and the tools, to continue the response. So there is a lot of worry about this as we head into the winter.
I want to keep talking about the politics of all this because the midterm election is less than 2 weeks away, and it's looking pretty clear that the Republicans are going to take over the House, and that has ramifications for that funding that you're talking about, I suspect. But before we do that, let's take a call. We have Mary from Randolph Center calling in. Welcome, Mary. You're on the phone with Ann Sosin of Dartmouth College.
Hi, Mary. Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Ann. Kevin, I always enjoy your shows, too, by the way.
Thank you.
So one of my defenses against, you know, any illness, colds, flu, viruses, all of that, and we don't hear about that, I don't think, enough, is building up our very, very vital immune system. And we can do that. We have that ability to build our immunity with, there's lots of resources out there. All you have to do is Google build my immunity probably and things will come up. But that's one of my major defenses, you know, is good food, some exercise. I take supplements personally. I think that helps. And that's what I do is, and among other things, of course. But I don't think we hear enough about that people, we have the ability in our own hands to build our immunity towards many, many things.
Oh, Mary, thank you for the call. Let's take that up because two things. I read, Anne, last week about a new study, and I can't remember where it came from, that some 70% of the food that we are now consuming in this country is not healthy. And then the data, which you know better than me, about the deaths from COVID are dramatic in the sense of many, many, many of the people who died had other comorbidities. They were overweight. They had diabetes, et cetera. So what's Mary onto there in terms of building your immune system?
So certainly we want to do everything we can to, you know, maintain good health. I definitely, you know, appreciate that comment. being in good health really positions you to take the hit of an infection if and when it happens. That's a more general. I'd urge everyone to have a little caution around thinking that, because there are a lot of things beyond our control or in our environment that shape our health. Not all of us have access to adequate and nutritious foods. Right. Many people are living in food deserts where they can't access them. And those factors shape our health in ways that make us at greater risk of infection. And so those of us who think a lot about health equity are often thinking about what are the forces beyond us that are shaping our health.
Boy, that's a topic for an entire show. So what are those forces shaping our health? Talk about that a little bit. You've done a lot of work in rural communities, and rural communities are beset by food deserts. They don't have access to healthy food. So talk more about that, if you would.
Sure. So our health is shaped by the places we live, the places we work, the places we learn, that we play, by our natural environment. It's the air that we breathe or the water that we drink or use is contaminated. That affects our health. And so, while there's often a very narrow focus on individual decision making, many things go beyond our control in thinking about our health. And that's why we really need a systems or level or collective approach to many health challenges. To take, a couple of examples from COVID that kind of illustrate this nicely, we saw very early on that many people who were infected were living in congregate or shared living settings, our nursing
homes. Anne, why don't you hold that till after the break? We're breaking for CBS News. You're listening to WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back with Anne Sosin of Dartmouth College. We're talking about COVID. Anne, I'm so sorry I had to cut you off before the break. You were talking about rural communities and people's health depends on where they live, what they eat, where they go to school, where they work. Can you I cut you off, so keep going.
Sure. So just to pick up where we left off, in COVID, we've seen during the pandemic, we've seen that our exposure to the virus often depends on the places where we're living. If we're living in a congregate setting, like a prison or a nursing home, or on a campus, we have far greater exposure to the virus, especially early on when many things were closed. We also know COVID spreads very rapidly in settings that don't have any mitigation in place. And schools and campuses now largely are unmitigated. So we also see that the type of work we do brings exposure not only to COVID but to other occupational threats, and we talk about the ways in which these things that are very factors shape health is the social determinants of health. We think of our health as not simply biologically determined, but also a product of all of these other factors.
Right. Got it. We are going to take another call. We have Fred from Newbury on the line. Fred, you're on the line with Anne Sosin of Dartmouth College. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Can you tell me what city did patient zero live in?
That's okay. Fred, thank you for the call. I really appreciate it. Boy, I think that's getting into – this is a deep down, Anne, you probably know this issue better than I do, but can you venture a discussion about that question?
Yeah, so thanks, Fred, for your question. We know that the pandemic started in the city of Wuhan in China. We don't have a patient zero that has been identified, but it spread from there. There's been a lot of discussion and debate about the origins of the pandemic, but what scientists have demonstrated, and there continues to be some discussion around that, is that the pandemic most likely started in a market in that city.
Right. Fred, thanks for the call. Fred's question, I think, leads us to another discussion, which is there is Vermont has a reputation, well-deserved, for some contrarian thinking, while at the same time we are believers in public health, and sometimes those come into conflict, especially when you get around politics. We have an anti-vaccination segment here that's vocal, and we have a media that is increasingly on a national level tribal, and raising questions about vaccines and the virus, where it came from. There's conspiracy theories, etc. How do you recommend that the rest of us navigate the media, the politics, and the facts or non-facts around all of this?
That's a great question, and I know it's become increasingly difficult,
right,
to navigate the information that we're getting about COVID and other threats. There has been a proliferation of misinformation spread through a lot of sources, and sometimes it's hard to separate high-quality information, especially when the evidence is evolving very quickly on COVID, from outright misinformation or attempts to mislead the public. So I would say that looking to some of the more official sources of information, and again, that's not always that easy, given how quickly the evidence is changing. Social media is unfortunately a place where a lot of misinformation gets spread, so I would be very cautious about things that are circulating on places like Facebook or TikTok or other sites that many use for their social activities as well as for consuming information. And there are, a couple of good newsletters out there, but unfortunately, there has been a vacuum of really good information coming from more official places, including the CDC, and many groups have stepped in to fill that vacuum.
So you bring up the CDC. I kind of feel like that we are in a sort of a changing of the guard. Dr. Fauci is retiring. I see that Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, has COVID. How do you – Dr. Shah is now in charge of the White House COVID policy. How do you see the federal government's role and the government's response both to this point and going forward? You don't need to give them a grade, but the CDC still is the expert on this issue. But I take it that you have criticisms of the way they've acted in the past and going forward.
Yeah, so many of us have been critical of the response at policy level and, have expressed concerns that policies are driving the science that the public is seeing versus science informing the guidance in the public that is being issued. There's been a lot of focus on what happens at lower levels of the CDC in terms of emerging science being taken up in the guidance, but many worry that there has been far too much political influence into the guidance that we're seeing. And let me bring up one example of this to illustrate
what I'm talking about.
So in late December, as the Omicron variant took hold, the CDC issued new guidance saying that individuals needed to isolate for only 5 days. And many chimed in. They said the evidence supported it, but really we didn't have evidence at that time to support that recommendation. And so, and we now have a lot of evidence, so many scientific papers showing that the most people remain infectious or can transmit the virus to others beyond 5 days. And yet we continue to live by this five-day guidance, and many are perplexed when they are still testing positive well past 5 days. Many institutions have adopted this guidance. Our schools here are using it and said that if we are, if we're setting policy that doesn't reflect the evidence and we're continuing to say that it, this reflects what the science shows, that we're really degrading not only the policy process, but the scientific process. And so many of us said we need to set standards that reflect the best science, not what the economy or other interests dictate, and then do what we can to implement them better.
Boy, that's a mouthful. So if you get COVID, as I did, and I went by the 5 day guidance, what do you recommend in terms of isolating yourself from your family members in the house?
So what we really want to be using is what we call test to exit, and that means testing negative on rapid antigen tests before exiting isolation. You shouldn't be surprised if you're still positive on a rapid antigen test at day 6, 7, 8, 9, sometimes even longer than that. That's really what we expect to see. And let me also, if you don't mind, clear up some of the confusion that many have around antigen tests and how they can be used with this.
Yeah, please.
Rapid antigen tests are a really good public health tool because they tell us when we are infectious or when we can transmit the virus to other people around us. And so we can use them to know when can we go back to our activities without endangering those in our workplaces, our schools, or other settings. And so if you're seeing a rapid test take a little bit of time to turn positive, that's normal. We expect that now with Omicron and people being vaccinated and boosted. And if you're taking some time for the rapid antigen test to turn negative, we also expect that. That doesn't mean the tests aren't working. It means that they're working to tell us when we can resume, we can safely resume the things that we did when we didn't have COVID.
Got it. Okay. How do you look back on the CDC's performance, both in the Trump administration and the Biden administration? Two different approaches. Maybe you could describe those approaches and talk about whether they worked, whether they didn't.
You know, so the CDC is a really large agency, they faced many challenges during the early phase of the pandemic, and there was a review that was conducted recently that identified several reforms that need to happen in the CDC, one being that their science needs to be translated into public guidance much more quickly. There's a lot that goes on at the CDC out of view. For example, many CDC teams were engaged in outbreak responses in our, meatpacking plants, our nursing homes, and other places. So I do want to say the CDC is not just Rochelle Walensky or other very prominent leaders. It's a really large agency that responds to a lot of public health challenges. I think that there has been concern both during the Trump and the Biden administration, though, that at high levels, some of the guidance that's being issued from the CDC or the decisions that have been made, have been politically influenced. They're not simply translating science into policy or guidance, but they're responding to cues from elsewhere. And so we really have to think not simply about what goes on, in terms of the science that's being produced, but how do we insulate the CDC perhaps from political influence in the future. How do we ensure that there is some separation from science, between science and policy?
Okay, thank you. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the state of Vermont. I think we all still remember the 3 times a week press conferences with Governor Scott and his health commissioner, Dr. Levine. We've now emerged into a completely different world where kids are back in school. They're not necessarily wearing masks. I'm actually teaching a course at UVM where, you know, masks are optional. Some of the students are wearing masks, some are not. You're a Vermonter. What's the state government response been in your eyes, effective or not effective?
Yeah, so we've seen an evolution in the Vermont response over time. I think we can, you know, categorize it into different periods. We saw a really effective and disciplined response early in the pandemic, leading up to the introduction of vaccines in late 2020. We saw a really effective campaign to deliver vaccines to the population. But I, you know, have argued in many places that, you know, we saw an erosion of or the retreat from some of the effective policies and practices that we saw early in the pandemic as time wore on. The state dropped all restrictions in summer once 80% of the population was vaccinated. I think that was a good decision at the time and really set an example for the country. But I think that unfortunately, where was really a retreat from some of the strong things or good lessons once Delta set in last fall. You know, we didn't see an aggressive response. And unfortunately, you know, we lost a lot of Vermonters during the Delta and the Omicron surge. If we had borne down, you know, harder and pushed other measures while we boosted our older and high-risk Vermonters, some of them would be with us today. And so it's been at times very critical of the response because I've seen outcomes later on that don't reflect the same level of leadership and effort that we saw at earlier phases of the pandemic.
How many Vermonters have we lost, Anne? Do you have that off the top of your head?
I do. So as of last week, tragically, we had lost 734 Vermonters.
Right.
You know, and many, you know, after the introduction of vaccines. So during the Delta and Omicron phases.
Right. And we are still losing nationally hundreds of citizens per day. And this is, again, that gap between your world, the public health world, and, you know, what we should be doing versus the cultural world of what we want to be doing, going to sporting events. And that gap leads to a death toll that if the number of people who died every day in this country, and I don't have it in front of me, were to go down in a plane crash, we would be assembling all the forces of the government to make sure that we didn't happen again. And yet we are tolerating at some level these deaths. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, so tragically we have normalized a very high level of death in this country. Each week we're losing about the equivalent of a 9/11 attack.
Right.
And that's at a period of time when we're characterizing the pandemic as an improved state. And before we head into the winter months. And, you know, I worry that we've really reset our expectations and normalized such high levels of loss that it's going to be, you know, very hard for us to pivot. The other thing that I want to mention is that in addition to the very high death toll, we're also seeing an enormous footprint of disability. We haven't talked about long COVID.
Oh, please do.
But we, you know, many Americans are living with long COVID right now in Vermont. Just under 5% report currently experiencing symptoms consistent with long COVID. And almost 1% of Vermonters, or 1 in 100 Vermont, 1 in 100 Vermonters report experiencing very significant activity limitations from long COVID. And so long after COVID is something that we think about, we're going to see many people who continue to be impacted by the pandemic.
That, just a sort of a personal question for you, as in your professional life, that must be incredibly frustrating for you to be going about your business. I know you live in Vermont, but you spend a lot of time in Hanover, walking down the street in Hanover and seeing people gathering at Murphy's Tavern or in the football stadium at Dartmouth College. That must be, you must look at this behavior and shake your head.
You know, I'm much more focused on how do we get to better policies, because I've seen the extraordinary ways that so many of us have, you know, changed our activities and done things that were really unprecedented. And so I guess I have a lot more faith in the public right now than many do. And so we really want better policies, better guidance to shape behaviors rather than better neighbors and community members.
Right.
I don't think we give nearly enough credit to many in our communities who radically reorganized their lives in a very short period of time and sustained very significant changes.
Well, I remember, I mean, it's amazing the road that we've all traveled. I mean, we called our kids back from around the country. They flew home. We were wiping down our groceries as it came through the front door. We really changed our behavior in drastic ways.
And, you know, masking is something that has been very politicized in our country.
Yeah.
But we have lots of data showing the overwhelming number of Americans, not only masked, maybe not, you know, all of the time, but they adopted this new behavior. And then most Americans actually support masking at critical moments during the pandemic response. And so, and that's not a behavior that was common to any of us prior to March 2020. So, you know, there's been a lot of attention to lack of compliance with public health behaviors, but not nearly enough to the changes many have made. In order to control the pandemic and to protect those that are around them.
And I would recommend for a good N95 mask, there's the N95 project run by my friend Anne, who actually lives in Essex, Vermont, and you can get high-quality N95 masks at that organization. Quickly, in 30 seconds, Anne, please tell us the three things that people can do as they go into winter.
Get boosted, get masks and tests, and let's stay in this together. When we have a village versus virus mentality, we all come out stronger.
Anne Sosin of Dartmouth College, you're so kind to join us. I really, really appreciate it. And we'll see you down the road. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis, your host. We are taking your calls this half hour, 244-1777. You can also reach us by email at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And we'll take your calls and questions about anything. We just listened to Anne Sosin about COVID. She was an expert from Dartmouth College, a national expert in public health. We can talk the election, which is coming up. I am working to get Becca Ballant, the Democratic nominee for Vermont's lone House seat in Washington, on the show. She's agreed. We're just working out the schedules. Governor Scott, of course, has an open invitation to come on the show at any time, as does Senator Leahy. And I've been in touch with his people to have the senator come on. It's a short drive from his home in Middlesex, and the Senate is on recess, so I suspect that Senator is in Middlesex, and if you're listening, come on the show. We'd love to have you. We can talk about my interview on Monday with the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Maggie Haberman about her book about Donald Trump, the former president. And that interview led to lots of interesting reactions. I got lots of private texts and emails, lots of phone calls, and it was great to have a journalist of national stature on WDEV. We will continue to get guests like that on this show as I host it on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays going forward. We'll be talking about politics. We'll be talking about the elections. We'll be talking about COVID. We'll be talking about all things Vermont. I thought Ann Sosin's comments, she's obviously, I wanted to bring that up, and she met her response was forceful, which is, we have a strong element in Vermont that questions the value of vaccines. They talk about it around the freedom and health liberty. And I wanted Ann to address that issue. Fred from Newbury addressed it a little bit with his question about patient one, which is a concept that I am not that familiar with. So I wanted Ann to talk about it. Ann is clearly a very pro vaccine, even and very pro mask, and very pro putting in place using all the tools you possibly can to ward off the flu and COVID and other respiratory illnesses that are in the air and coming around. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about schools and put ourselves in the place of parents sending their kids to schools. Did Ann think that school children should be masked or unmasked? I mentioned that I'm teaching a course at UVM, and it's interesting to see who comes to the class in masks and who doesn't. I'm just fascinated by this by this divide, not so much a political divide, but the divide between those who are saying, I am getting back to my life, and I am not going to mask, and I'm not going to adjust my behavior. I'm going out tonight. I'm going to the movies. I'm going to the bar. I'm going to the football game. I'm going to the school play. And my own children are like this. They're saying, I'm done. If I get COVID, I get COVID. And I will recover. And what Ann is saying is that behavior ignores the risk of long COVID. It ignores the risk of deeper problems that people are experiencing with heart ailments and other problems. But as long as we've been alive, young people have thought they're invincible. And you only learn you're not invincible until you learn the hard way. And that's the chance we take with living. The elections are coming up. The debates are in full swing. On the national stage, it's pretty clear that we saw the Pennsylvania debate last night between Dr. Oz and Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who had a stroke. That race is tightening. The race for the United States Senate in Nevada is tightening. The race in Arizona for governor is fascinating. I'm out there, Democrats are in such a powerful majority in Vermont, it's difficult to find Republicans in competitive races. One race that's interesting is the state Senate race in Orange County, which features the incumbent Mark McDonald, who's been there for a long, long time. I don't have the years off the top of my head. Against Republican John Klar, who has cast doubt on the presidential election results. And we are going to have John Klar on the show as a guest in the 10 o'clock hour on October 28th. In the 9 o'clock hour on October 28th, guess who we are going to have? The one, the only, Rusty DeWeese. He of Lamoille County, he of acting fame, and he of the logger fame. And it's always fun to sit down with Rusty and talk about, gosh, anything under the sun. I mean, boy, if there's a guy who can riff, that's the guy. And if you're looking for some fun online, follow Rusty on Instagram, because he is it's a lot of fun. He plays music. He's having a special guitar custom made for himself on his performances. So that's going to be a good show on the 28th. Rusty DeWeese in the 9 o'clock hour and John Klar in the 10 a.m. hour. Send us your questions. If you got questions for a guy like John Klar, who I don't know much about, but I'll be doing my research, please do so. And October 31st, we're going to have as a guest Linda Flanagan, who is a national expert on youth sports and kids, and how, in her belief, that the youth sports scene in this country is spiraled completely out of control at the hands of overzealous parents and hucksters making a buck off the backs of kids, and the fear and the insecurity and the anxieties of parents who want to get their kids, who think their kids are going to be the next LeBron James, when in fact all those kids should be doing is playing healthy sports and doing other things. So that's going to be that's the schedule going forward. I look forward to the conversation with John Klar, because I used to live in Orange County and know a lot about it. We lived in Stratford and Chelsea for many years. The technical term would be South Washington, for those sticklers out there in Orange County. We lived in South Washington for many years, but our mailing address was Chelsea, just like you can live in East Montpelier now, today, as I do, and your mailing address is Montpelier. So if you put East Montpelier on the envelope, it's going to get sent back. Still a mystery to me, but that's rural Vermont for you. We're going to take a break. We'll come back on the other side and talk about a little more about the elections. And we'll see you on the other side. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back. We're 15 minutes away from our next guest, which is going to be Richard Wabi, who's going to be talking to us about Wheels for Warmth, which is the tire donation program. And I can't wait to hear about that. We'll do that from 10 to 10:30. As I said earlier, on the October 28th show, Friday, we're going to have Rusty DeWeese at 9 a.m. And we're going to have State Senate candidate from Orange County, John Klar, who's the Republican nominee for that seat, running against Mark McDonald. The reason I mentioned that race, and I think that one of the reasons I wanted to have Klar on the show, is because Klar has got some, you know, interesting. It'll be very interesting to see if a guy like Klar, who I have never met him or spoken to him, but he has a reputation for being well spoken. He will have some of the more, I think, rightward views of the current Republican Party, and it'll be interesting to see if he can beat Mark McDonald, who, like John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, recently suffered a stroke. And I know that from reading V.T. Digger and others that Mark is well. He's taken some days in the hospital, and then I believe he is on the way to a full recovery. I've known Mark McDonald for 1,000 years. He served in the House. He's a school teacher in Randolph. He then has served many, many years in the state Senate, on the Finance Committee, on the Natural Resources Committee. And he's been, he's had a heck of a career. And this is, you know, it's interesting to go back in time for those of you old enough. I'm going to do this off the top of my head, but when Vermont passed the same-sex civil unions law in 2000, it was a very close vote, and I remember I was the, back then I was the lobbyist for the same-sex marriage nonprofit group and political action committee, so I was involved in that. And I remember when Peter Shumlin, former Governor Peter Shumlin, who was then running the Senate, went to Mark McDonald and said, I don't think this has ever been revealed, actually. He said to McDonald, because McDonald was wavering on whether to vote for civil unions or not. And Shumlin, as president of the Senate, went to McDonald and said, you don't have to vote for this. You can vote no. Even though you want to vote yes, you want to vote your conscience and vote yes, go ahead and vote no, because that'll help you keep your seat. And McDonald was going back and forth. I'd love to have Mark on the show when he's up to it and come back and talk about that, because Mark was visibly going back and forth about what to do. Should he do the politically convenient route and vote against civil unions, or should he vote his conscience and vote for it? He went to the floor. A bunch of us were watching. It was quite a tense moment, and he gave a speech, which you can find in the Vermont archives. He gave a speech in which he laid it out. He said, I think I could get reelected if I voted no, but I'm going to vote my conscience. He voted yes. He lost his seat. If there's anybody out there that wants to call in and correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong, please do. He voted yes. He lost his seat. The Democrats lost the majority in the state Senate and the House of Representatives to the Republicans for, I believe, 4 years. And then and Mark McDonald lost his seat to Steve Webster, who became chair of the Senate Finance Committee. You can see, ladies and gentlemen, that I can talk about this kind of thing for pretty much forever, because it's been my life. And so Mark lost his seat. Then I believe it was 4 years later, I might have that wrong, he made a comeback and won the seat back, and he's had that Senate seat in Orange County ever since. Under redistricting, that Senate seat lost a town, the town of Thetford, and gained a town, the town of Bradford. And so that Orange County Senate seat, that district moved a little more conservative than it used to be. Thetford is a reliably blue town, close to Dartmouth, lots of Dartmouth people, whereas Bradford skews a little more conservative. And so a guy like John Klar, I don't know his politics yet. I'll do the research, but it'll be interesting to see whether Klar can dig into McDonald's long-time support in Orange County. When we lived in Chelsea, which was a pretty conservative town, but Mark would always coast to victory on the strength of Thetford and some of those more liberal towns in Orange County. So we'll have Klar on Friday in the 10 o'clock hour after Rusty Deweese at 9 a.m. And, of course, we've had Brenda Siegel, the Democratic challenger for governor. We've had her on the show. We have an open invitation to Governor Scott to come on anytime. I think he's had some scheduling issues and and we promise to keep at it. I've just received a message back from Senator Leahy's staff. They love the idea of him coming on. So the seat is always warm for him. As to other races, I know that up in the St. Albans, Franklin County area, there are some House races that we want to keep our eye on. Democrats are always pushing hard for, you know, we need to raise more money and we need to win these races because we need a veto-proof majority. But that's, you know, Democrats, barring catastrophe, are going to hold the legislature, in a very, very strong way. So, you know, that raises the issue of maybe I should have Patty McCoy or some of the Republican leadership on the show to talk about how do you behave in the minority? You know, what's it like? You don't control much. You don't appoint people to committees. You don't control the agenda. You don't control the schedule. So if you're in the minority and you're in leadership, how do you get anything done for your constituency that voted for you? That's an interesting question. The other show I wanted to do was I want to do a show about losing. Several shows, in fact. You know, we focus in this country a lot on winning, and the credit always goes to the winners, and we celebrate them and turn them into heroes and celebrities. But we don't often talk to the people who stick their neck out and then fail and come up short. And I'm thinking of Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, who just ran a race for Congress and lost to Becca Ballant. And as I said earlier, we're going to have Becca Ballant on the show. I'm thinking of Kitty Toll, who was a very, very respected and successful House member from Danville, chair of the House Appropriations Committee, a moderate, very responsible, highly respected legislator. The legislature was a huge part of my life. I spent 22 years as a lobbyist, consultant, and PR executive in Montpelier and ran a firm called Kimball Sherman Ellis, helped run a firm as part of a team. And so the legislature was a big part of my life. And people like Kitty Toll, who come to work every day and do the hard work, always earned my respect. I'd like to have Kitty on the show. And the question is, you know, not to relitigate, you know, the race that they lost, but to pay them the respect and pick apart and examine what's it like to lose. What's it like to go out, declare your candidacy, go out there and raise the money, go from town to town giving talks and speeches, going on TV and radio, being peppered with questions by the press, trying to make, and all the while trying to make a living, and do your other job, whether it's lieutenant governor or whether it's, in Kitty's case, the serving as a legislator. Not to mention, if you have another job, you're attending to the home front. I know Kitty comes from a farming family, and there's a lot of work going on in that family every day. What's it like to come up short? Kitty lost a race, a Democratic primary, to David Zuckerman, by the way, who we have not had on the show. So we're going to talk to some folks who came up short, and we're going to ask them the hard questions about what's that like? What does that do? How long does it take to recover from rejection? Not trying to embarrass anybody. We're trying to inform and we're trying to enlighten. So, stay tuned for that series of shows. Because I think, there's a lot to be said there. And as I said, we're going to have noted author Linda Flanagan on about youth sports. And boy, you talk about winning and losing. You know, I remember the days when you just stayed outside all day and you were at the basketball court or the playground or the soccer field or whatever. And today it's become so specialized and there's so much money at stake. So on October 31st, we're going to have noted author Linda Flanagan talking about youth sports. So we will get to all that. You can find me at kevinkellis.com. If you want to subscribe to my blog, weekly political blog, just click the subscribe button, type in your email. It comes for free. And other than that, we will see you in the next half hour in just a few minutes, where our guest will be Richard Wabi, and we'll be talking about the Wheels for Warmth program. I'm Kevin Ellis. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint, and you're listening on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back. It's Kevin Ellis. It's Vermont Viewpoint. You can reach me at 244-1777, and I hope you will. We take your questions, your criticisms, your concerns. 1-877-291-8255, or you can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Our guest is Richard Wabi, and we're talking about Wheels for Warmth. If you're from Montpelier, Barry, or Central Vermont, you generally know Richard Wabi. Gosh, he had a jewelry store on State Street in Montpelier. He's had a bunch of different lives, but most importantly, Richard Wabi sat next to me in the Barry Auditorium when we were getting vaccinated.
And hey, I'm up to number 5. Where are you?
Oh my God! You mean your vaccination?
Yeah,
I'm.
I mean, every time they turn around and say I can go get another shot, I run out and get another shot.
Well, I was with my wife, who, of course, doesn't accompany me much in public anymore because every time I'm walking down the street, I see somebody I know and I have to wave. So Wabi and I are getting vaccinated near each other, and I, of course, in the Barry Auditorium Gymnasium, call across the gymnasium to him, "Hey, Wabi!" And of course, the question was, "Is the governor?" Because Richard Wabi and Governor Scott are friends, longtime friends. Is the governor going to run again? And of course, you yelled something back across the entire gymnasium for the entire public to hear. It was very funny.
So I listen to your show from time to time. I'm listening this morning. You and I should sit for a half an hour and just talk about this political landscape.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. We will book it.
You mentioned the governor. Of course, he and I grew up together from the age of, 10 or 12.
Yeah.
I mean, not many people have friends that they've had with them for 50 years. So well, that's a whole nother.
Well, would you please tell him that I'm
semi private?
Yeah. Well, would you please tell him that I'm waiting for him to come on the show? And there's a question I want to ask him, which you could talk about quickly. My question for him is, he's running for a fourth term, and I like to ask this of all these people: why bother? Why put yourself out there in public? It's really difficult. You know, it's hard work. It's getting more and more thankless every year. And the governor's running for a fourth term. You know, it would be easy to pack it in, call it a career, go back to the race car and the construction company or God knows whatever. I mean, he's a young guy, so there's plenty to do. That's the question I really want to ask him is, what keeps you going and why do you want to do it again?
Right? So, so I'll, I'll give that from a personal standpoint, not
sure.
from speaking for anybody.
Yeah, please.
He's a fiscal conservative.
Yeah.
He is. Then he's got his liberal bends. But his concern is that there is, particularly following the pandemic, within the pandemic, within this whole ARPA thing, the IIJA funding sources, he is very concerned about the way we may spend money,
yeah.
or the uses of that, those financial pieces we have. And because of that, he believes he's probably one of the best stewards that Vermont has had, and he wants to help steward those funds so they don't just get thrown away on 1 year. This is my interpretation.
Yeah.
1 year uses, 1 year here. You know the funny thing? I was listening to Lola Danforth yesterday trying to drill him at the end. I don't know any politicians that have stood up and said, I'm voting outside my party this year.
Yeah.
I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. I'm going to vote for, you know, Becca or Peter Welch. I don't know any politicians that have done that.
Did he say that? I missed that. Did he say he's voting for outside his party?
He announced that 2 years ago.
Well, that's
when
true.
He said he was voting for Biden.
Yeah, that's right. That's
and,
right.
And he stuck up for that.
Yeah, that's
Yet
right.
Yet everybody's putting him on the hot seat. Who are you voting for? What are you doing? I think we ought to ask some of the other party. Because what's happened is we've divided this country based on party, not based on what we can accomplish, what we can do, and how we can work together. And my friend is a very true believer in working together.
Yeah.
He's proven that. And that's, I mean, that's part of where Wheels for Warmth originated.
Oh, right? Good segue. Okay, keep going.
He looked at need. He looked at, we have resources. We have this. And he and Wayne Lamberton and myself were sitting around one afternoon, and he said, you know, I got a mess of tires in my shop, in my garage, and Wayne said the same thing. What are we going to do with them? It would be nice to get them to somebody that can use them because they don't fit our vehicles anymore. And we literally, in an hour and a pie plate, came up with Wheels for Warmth. And we pulled this together so that there are some people out there that are less fortunate, that need some help in some fashion. And originally it was just to move tires. And as we thought about it, we realized that we're going to take money in on these tires in some fashion. And with that money, we should be helping the Emergency Fuel Relief Fund.
Right.
And then we said, boy, if we're bringing good tires in, we're going to get bad tires. The DMV folks were out of this world. They said they'd volunteer and inspect tires. And we said, we'll get those tires out of the waste stream. Nothing is worse than looking at tires stacked as you go down the road or kayak down the rivers. And we said, we'll get those out of the wayside. And who should appear but John Casella and Casella Waste. And they said, we don't care what you take in. You take it in. We'll get rid of it. We'll recycle it. It won't go into our landfills. We'll recycle it. And when you look at Phil was standing there saying, this is the right thing to do. And I commend him probably every time I see him because his honor sits there on the table. And it's, we have to do the right thing for everyone. It doesn't matter if I'm a Republican, you're a Democrat, you're a progressive. What's the right thing? And this Wheels for Warmth, non-political, nothing, is strictly the right thing to do for our community and our neighbors and our friends that are less fortunate than we are.
So tell us, I've got the notes in front of me and I got a bunch of detail that we should get to. Because, let's do it.
$650,000, 25,000 tires sold, 50,000 tires recycled. There, I threw it all. I puked it for you.
Okay, October 27th and 28th, from 2 to 6.
Thursday and Friday,
DMV inspection sites, Casella Construction in Mendon, Vermont, the Vermont Granite Museum, Casella Waste Systems in Williston, and from 1 to 5 at the Mayo Farm Events Field in Stowe. That's for, okay, and then there's non-DMV inspection drop-off sites. Colchester at Dick Mazza's store. Boy, there's a, that's a surprise.
Now look at that, right? So Mazza passes over the fence and says, this is a good thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it with him.
Waitsfield Village Grocery on the 11th.
That one just got shut down, by the way.
Okay.
Troy did a fabulous job. Three roll-offs full of tires coming out of Village Grocery.
Okay, now that's the drop-off information. Now let's go to the tire sale. If you want to get rid of tires, Saturday, October 29th, tire sale from 8 to 12 p.m. at the Barry Granite Museum in Barry or at Casella Construction in Mendon, Vermont. That's if you want to get rid of your tires.
No, if you want to buy new tires.
Oh, if you want to buy new tires.
New tires. If you want to buy tires on Saturday.
Got it.
It's
okay.
At the Vermont Granite Museum and Casella. Can I tell you a quick, fast story in the middle of this?
Go for it.
So we came out of the pandemic, and we had to take a year off.
Yeah, you canceled last year, right?
Year before. And we were concerned that Wheels probably ran its path. It's probably done. We'll give it one last shot and see what happens. The outpouring of support, the number of people in need, the number of people willing to help their neighbors, that was overwhelming to the extent that we outgrew our original Montpelier location at Du Bois down here. It just couldn't handle it anymore.
Yeah.
And it blew us away. And the people at the Vermont Granite Museum up there in Barrie on Jones Brothers Way, they offered their site. It's twice as big. We can move people through semi-easier. It just works based on the size and reception we had last year. So this year, we're in essence reinventing the central Vermont location up there at the Vermont Granite Museum.
Ah.
The outpouring last year was phenomenal. We literally, because of that, outgrew our location at Du Bois, and we're now in Barrie this year.
Okay, and I'm going to read the list of the people who get the money that's raised.
God, that'll take like 5 minutes right there.
Well, let's see. Capstone Community Action, Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity in Northwestern Vermont, among others. So
And Brock.
And Brock.
The Bennington-Rutland Office of Opportunity down in Rutland. And what actually happens is we take all these tires in from these different locations and whatnot, and over Thursday and Friday from 2 to 6 each day, we're collecting tires in Mendon and Barry and Stowe, Williston, up at the Casella location in Williston. We collect all those tires. They all are transported in the evening after dark because that's right. We shut those down. We bring them all back into either Rutland or Barry. They're separated, inspected, packed up, lined up, getting ready to go, and we do that 2 days in a row. And then Saturday morning, bright and early at 8 o'clock, at both the Rutland or the Mendon Mountain location and the Granite Museum location, we have a four-hour sale that I don't know if you've gone out and priced winter tires lately.
Oh, yeah.
But they're about $100 a piece if you get a good buy. And we're selling tires for a maximum of, I think, $30 a piece. So for $120, you can put your hands on a decent set of tires that'll get you through a winter or two.
Dick, how much have you guys raised in those 17 years that goes to emergency fuel assistance? Do you know?
Yeah, I do. But can we start down a different road real fast?
You go right ahead.
I started off saying it was Wayne and Phil and I, and we kind of put this plan together. There was half a dozen volunteers back then, that first year, 17 years ago, that really helped and made it possible. But what's happened in 17 years, what's happened in the past, in this time frame, is to date, we've raised $610,000, and it's been because of people like Bourne's who jump out and help us out. VSECU, the Vermont State Employees Credit Union, jumped in. Casella, of course, McKenzie, even parking people, the traffic control folks, ADA, jumped in and said, we'll help you park people. So when you start to look at what made this work, what gave us the ability to raise that $610,000 to give to the emergency heating fund, it really was a community. It was all these people that were willing to gather together this one weekend out of the year and make this happen for those people less fortunate and those people in need. So I can't say enough about that lineup of people. Even Jeff Blow up there at Jet Service, printing posters and doing social media stuff for us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable how people just, you know, you don't realize, and all of a sudden they just take this on. I'll do it. Don't worry about it. So really got to commend all those people. But you asked about money. $610,000 over 17 years. We're expecting to break the $650,000, $655,000 mark this year.
Okay.
We have, and I hit on this earlier, we've removed 50,000 tires from our landfills, our waste streams, and we've actually put them, they actually go into a recycling mode that you probably see them when you've got your kids and you're out playing on the playgrounds and you see the black chips underneath the playground pieces. That's part of our tires. If you watch a football game on TV and you see this black dust jump up in the air,
yeah,
that's recycled tires.
Yeah.
So these things are actually not going into landfills or burn pits. They're actually being used and reused in another form.
And you're selling 25,000 safe tires to raise
yes.
money. Yeah.
Over the course of 17 years, yes, we sell somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,700 to 2,000 tires, 500 sets roughly, each year. Again, $100 a set.
Wow.
Right? Where can you buy a set of tires for $100?
Yeah.
Well, this weekend, this Saturday, you can buy them down at Mendon at Casella Construction. We're up here in Barrie at the Vermont Granite Museum. And you don't have to be in need, and I say in need to come buy them, because your $100 that you pay for your tires help us heat homes all winter long, right?
Let me ask you a dumb question. When I show up with my Prius, is somebody going to help me fit the right tires to buy? I don't want to buy tires for a pickup truck when all I need is...
Just as long as you got $100, I don't care what tires you buy.
Okay, there's a key change this year, which is you're moving from Du Bois Construction to the Barrie Granite Museum. Talk about that again.
Well, and Kevin, let me answer. We are moving up to the Granite Museum in Barrie. We actually outgrew our location at Du Bois, so we're moving from Montpelier to Barrie. But the other key piece is our volunteers are coming in, same group of volunteers, same great people, and we've all been trained, semi-trained, to help people find the correct size tires for their vehicles, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18-inch tires. Then you got your R70s, your R53s, whatever it is. But we we actually inventory the tires so they're semi-easy for you to find at that given time.
Got it.
And we do have folks there to help you, not only help you, but to once you've purchased the tires, to assist you in getting them back to the vehicle so you can put them in your car. Now, if you're buying four tires for a Prius, Kevin, you're going to have to make two trips because you can't get four tires in the back of that thing.
I never should have revealed on the air what kind of car I drive.
but it's a, I mean, this is a great thing, and we just hit on it. We'll hit 650 this year. We'll probably be up around 28,000 sets of tires, 27,000, 28,000 tires. We'll get up over 50,000 recycled pieces. I mean, that's a great thing, and it's all happening at Mendon Mountain, or Mendon, Vermont, down there at Casella Construction, and up here at the Vermont Granite Museum in Barrie. And, I mean, we look forward to it. Hey, you know what's a funny one? You were talking politicians. This is the one thing I see is down in Rutland, all the local politicians get together. It doesn't matter what party, what separation, how you argued 3 months ago. They get together and they serve breakfast and or lunch on Saturday. And Central Vermont here at Jones Brothers Way, Representative Ghostlant and some of his cronies, both R's, D's, and P's, have all gathered together, and they're serving lunch up here. That was actually started, believe it or not, by Dick Mazza, who would bring food down, and we'd be cooking it out there. So we look forward to seeing a rainbow of politicians cooking meals and helping people with whatever they need to be helped with.
And where are you going to be for those, you know, Richard Wabi fans who want to come get an autograph? Where are you going to spend your time?
Most people would prefer, including my friend the governor, that I just stay in my office down here in Montpelier.
Right.
But I am I'm actually coordinating with Erica Scott, coordinating the Barrie site. That is a whole new venture for us. It's like starting out from scratch. So I'm coordinating. I will be in Barrie the whole time.
Okay. Say the website really fast.
I believe it's www.wheelsforwarmth.org.
Thank you.
Wheelsforwarmth.org. And thank you for having me today, Kevin.
Dick
thank you
Wabi,
very much.
Thanks a lot. That's the show for today. I'm Kevin Ellis. We'll see you on Friday. It's Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.